and Basin Street is a street where all the boys and the good folks meet down in New Orleans, in the land of dreams. And you never know how nice it seems and just how much it really means. Dear to me.
When Hurricane Ivan visited Cuba in September 2004, 1.9 million people were evacuated with zero deaths. This is in a country with a total population of 11.2 million. Salvana Briceno, the director of the UN International Strategy for Disaster Reduction, commented at the time, "The Cuban way could easily be applied to other countries with similar economic conditions, and even in countries with greater resources that do not manage to protect their population as well as Cuba does. Compare this with the U.S.'s response to Hurricane Katrina that hit New Orleans on Monday, August 29th of 2005. With advanced warning of the hurricane, the mayor of New Orleans ordered an evacuation of the city. However, unlike the collectivist approach of Cuba, evacuation in New Orleans was left to the individual to organize. This left tens of thousands of low-income African Americans as well as poor whites with neither a means of leaving nor a place to go. New Orleans is a city of about 500,000. 70% are black and 30% are living below the poverty line." Jordan Flaherty, a union organizer and an editor of Left Turn magazine, was in New Orleans when the Hurricane Katrina came to New Orleans. I talked to him on September 5th, 2005. So let's begin with your own story. Can you talk about why you decided to stay in New Orleans, the storm itself, and your own eventual evacuation from New Orleans?
Well, a lot of people stayed in New Orleans because they didn't have the resources. For myself, I didn't have a car. There was no rental cars available. There was no flights available. All of that was booked, and there was no other facilities made available. I also, I'm more fortunate than a lot of people in that I had a fairly sturdy place to stay in, and I live in a second floor apartment. And, you know, these disasters, whether it's the tsunami in Southeast Asia or the hurricane in New Orleans, they affect most the people with the least resources, the poorest folks, and that's certainly the case in New Orleans. The neighborhood that was flooded was the Ninth Ward and the Lower Ninth Ward, which is the most overexploited community in New Orleans, the community that, you know, it's something like 95% black, maybe even in the Lower Ninth Ward, maybe 98% black. There's a 40% illiteracy rate. Frederick Douglass High School in the middle of the Ninth Ward, I don't remember the exact statistic, but I believe less than 50% of their senior class will be graduated from high school this year. You have a huge amount of young black males from that area being taken to the Angola prison, which is a former slave plantation where the prisoners there, overwhelmingly black males, still do the same work that black males did there when it was a slave plantation. They're cutting sugar cane, they're picking cotton, they're also forced to perform, or, you know, they make a choice, but it's obviously a very limited consent when you're in prison. But they perform in this prison rodeo where people come from miles around to watch the prisoners in this rodeo for entertainment, where many of them are injured or killed. And more than 90% of the people in Angola prison end up dying in Angola prison. So New Orleans is a city that, and I have to talk about this because this is the real hurricane that hit New Orleans is not Hurricane Katrina. The real New Orleans hurricane was the hurricane of disinvestment, of deindustrialization, of neglect, of corruption. That's the hurricane, and that's what's been hitting the poor people of New Orleans for decades now, and that's what this was about. Hurricane Katrina was not such a big deal. Sunday night, it hit us. You know, we into Monday morning. When we got up Monday morning, we didn't have power and there was some flooding, but we felt like things were pretty much okay. Things were a little worse in the Ninth Ward, certainly, but we felt like, you know, the water was going to start getting pumped out. electricity work, you know, people would start working on it, and it would be back within a week or so. We felt like things would be okay. And then it was the following morning that the levee broke and the water rose another 9 feet. And the levee broke because the Bush administration and previous administrations, too, refused to do the shoring up, refused to build up the barrier islands around the city. You had just in the last year, FEMA requested $105 million for levees and other protection for the city, and the Bush administration cut it down to $40 million. You had back in early 2001, FEMA said that the three top potential catastrophes to hit the U.S. would be a terrorist attack in New York, a hurricane to hit New Orleans, and an earthquake to hit San Francisco. So all of this has been known. In the 1800s, at least since the 1800s, they've known that New Orleans was in danger of flooding, and it was an issue at the time. In 1927, New Orleans was flooded by a flooding of the Mississippi River, the great Mississippi River flood of 1927. And that flood, just like this flood, was about racism, and it was about politics. They didn't have to flood the areas that they flooded in 1927. They flooded Plaquemines Parish, just south of New Orleans, as a political decision. They purposely broke those levees and flooded that overwhelmingly black and poor community in 1927 to protect the richer and whiter communities that were upriver from Plaquemines Parish, to make sure that those communities were not in danger. They purposely broke the levees outside Plaquemines Parish. They promised those people then that they would be reimbursed for the damage to their homes, and they were never reimbursed. And you see the modern equivalent of that today. You know, and so since 1927, at least, people have known that this is a danger and this would happen. People knew it again and again. They refused to build up the city. And overwhelmingly, the mostly white, mostly wealthier uptown area did not get flooded. And we don't have all the answers of why that is, but we can certainly take some guesses about what this was about. So back to your question, I was in, I actually moved at the last minute from my apartment to a friend's apartment about 15 blocks away that was even more sturdy. It was an apartment building, a former warehouse. So we were even more protected. It was a five-story building. And while there, we rode out the storm. We were feeling good on Monday. Tuesday, things were certainly getting a lot worse. We tuned into the media, and we could see it was just what the mainstream media is always doing, which is making people terrified, making people scared. All they would talk about is the looting. Occasionally they would talk about flooding, but they would say maybe it was going to go up another 15 feet. They were just making people terrified and not giving any helpful information. Our governor, Governor Blanco, a day before the hurricane, went on to a press release, and she urged the people of New Orleans to try and pray the hurricane down to a level 2. On Tuesday night, it was announced that the waters might be rising up another 12 feet, and Governor Blanco went on the radio to say that she was calling for a day of prayer for Wednesday. So our state officials were doing nothing. Certainly, the federal officials, the Bush administration, were doing nothing. And the media and certain politicians were whipping up fears about the mostly black residents of the city, about looting, as if you could even call it looting when people have no food and no water and they're going into stores where the food and water is just going to go bad or is not going to be accessible to anyone for weeks, and they go and get that. Also, a lot of people had to actually pay to get out of New Orleans. So people were, in some cases, stealing so that they could trade to get out. People were charging for boat lifts out. People were charging for buses out. There's also been private companies, by the way, that have been doing major profiteering off of this, that have been paying to airlift wealthy people out. They've been paying for buses. There was a report of one hotel that paid $25,000 for a few buses to come in and evacuate people from the hotel. So, you know, we're seeing the privatization to some extent of that, of even the hurricane relief. And I think some of the looting was a response to that, and also a response to going back to 1927 when people's homes were destroyed and they never got the money to pay them back. If your home was destroyed in this flood, you would expect, if you're poor and black, that you might never see that money again. And so it would be very reasonable then to at least try and get yourself a stereo or a DVD player or something because that's all that you were getting.
And how did you yourself leave New Orleans?
So I stayed through till Thursday. At that point, there was more evacuations happening. There was very little in evacuations happening in those first few days. There was not helicopters. There was a lot of individual efforts, individuals going around by boat and picking people up. There was a lot of individual acts of kindness, which wasn't reported because they were too busy focusing on the looting. On that Thursday, the Coast Guard helicopter actually came down. A soldier jumped down and said that they were going to start evacuating the building. They evacuated a few elderly and infirm people off of the roof of the building, 9 people, on that Thursday morning. And then all through Thursday, there were boats going out to a little patch of land not far from the building we were in. And so I evacuated out Thursday evening. I was one of the last people in the building. And I got a ride from somebody on a boat. They took me to a patch of land where a helicopter came. And I think some people had waited on that patch of land for quite a while. But by the time I got there, a lot of people from our building, at least in our area, had evacuated. And there wasn't much of a line. So I then got that helicopter lift to a refugee camp. The refugee camp was maybe 2,000 people. About 90% of them were black and poor. People were behind barricades at the edge of a highway, an interstate highway. And there was National Guard and State Police and Salvation Army and Red Cross. The State Police and National Guard were there with guns, sort of patrolling the area, not pointing the guns at people, but telling people to stay behind the barricades. So people were behind the barricades just basically in piles of mud. There's no trash cans anywhere, so when people got food, the wrappers were just thrown on the ground. It was, you know, people were just standing in mud and trash. And there was no system at all. I talked to representatives from the National Guard, folks from the State Police, folks from Salvation Army, folks from the Red Cross. I even went to talk to all the journalists in that area, and I said to the journalists, have you talked to any officials or any official that is giving any information on how many buses are coming, when the buses are coming, where the buses are going to? And all of them, from a Fox News affiliate to German TV to Australian TV, were completely frustrated and said that the people running this were giving no information and either did not know what they were doing or were clearly neglectful. So you could not get any information about what was happening. A bus would pull up. It would pull up to a different spot every time, at least from what I saw in the time I was there. The state police would open up a gap in the barricades, and again, this gap would be at a different spot every time. People would rush onto the bus, and some people would be able to get on. And then there was no announcement while people were getting on of where the bus was going to. And once you were on the bus, they would tell you where the bus was going to. So, for example, if you got on a bus that was going to Arkansas, once you were on the bus, you'd find out you were going to Arkansas. Now, if you had family in Baton Rouge that you could stay with, Baton Rouge is about 1 hour from New Orleans. And you have to go through it to get to Arkansas. Arkansas, depending on where you're going, is, I'd say, at least 6 hours and probably longer. But while that bus is going, as it passes through Baton Rouge, even if you have family you could stay with, they would not stop and let you out in Baton Rouge. You were going to Arkansas. So people had no options, no information with which to make decisions. And as I say, there was no line. So there was no saying buses to Houston are stopping here, buses to Arkansas are stopping here, or here's one line for all the buses. People can get in a line. Here's where the buses will be stopping. None of that information was available. It doesn't take money or resources to give that information. It just takes caring about people, thinking about people, and feeling like you're dealing with humans and not some great mass that needs to be controlled. And that was the attitude that I feel like was coming from the top. I actually feel like the individual state police and National Guard, and I don't necessarily have anything against them, but the orders that they were getting were clearly not orders that were, you know, for dealing with humans. They were orders for dealing with a mass that they didn't really care about. And that's what I saw at this refugee camp. I actually ended up basically hitchhiking out of the refugee camp, and I got a ride from the Australian journalist, but, you know, that was not an option that was available to most people there in that refugee camp. People were waiting for many, many hours. Some people had been waiting for 12 hours. There was no special, you know, facilities or no special anything for people that were handicapped, for children. Again, it was just a mass of people getting onto the bus. A lot of people were just sitting on the side, not even trying to get on the bus because, you know, they didn't want to deal with the mass of people, or maybe they weren't able to. And there was no tents, there was no chairs. People were just sitting in the sun, sitting in the mud, sitting in the trash. And that was the refugee camp, and this is how the U.S. deals with the people of New Orleans.
What do you see as the reason behind the unorganized aid relief?
The federal government especially and you know, politicians in general and media in general do not care about the people of New Orleans. New Orleans is a place that is to me a very special place, and we can talk more about that later, but it is, I will just say briefly, it's a place that has brought a lot of culture into the U.S., where a lot of jazz and blues was born, a lot of hip-hop comes out of New Orleans, Mardi Gras, it's a tourist destination for the U.S. It's a very, you know, a lot of U.S. food, a lot of, you know, famous U.S. chefs come out of New Orleans. It's given a lot culturally to the U.S. and to the world, but the people of New Orleans get none of those resources. The people of New Orleans are overwhelmingly black and poor and overexploited, and they receive none of the resources of the U.S., and the people of the U.S. do not care about them. Bush flew over the hurricane area, I think it was Thursday, maybe it was Friday, and he then, you know, spoke to the press, and he was jovial. He was, you know, making jokes. He did not seem concerned. And then a day later, I think he got some comments from his handlers and tried to seem more concerned. But they don't care. They do not care.
Can you talk a little bit more about your impressions of the mainstream media's coverage of the events in New Orleans and how that compared to what you were actually seeing and experiencing?
Well, I will say that although New Orleans is a small town, when it's flooded, you can't see a lot of it. So, you know, I didn't see the Superdome, I didn't see the Convention Center, I didn't see Canal Street. But what I saw was people, you know, standing up for other people, and I saw community. And that's what I've always seen in New Orleans. And I've lived in New Orleans for several years, and I love the people of New Orleans. And it really hurt me to see how the media was portraying people. And it'll be a while, and, you know, we'll have to do a lot of oral histories before we really find out everything that happened in New Orleans and who was shooting who. Maybe you've talked to, or maybe you will be talking to, Malik Rahim, who's a longtime community activist and community organizer. I know he has stories of white vigilante gangs going around with guns that certainly was not reported by the media. He has stories of people who had to, as I was mentioning earlier, steal goods to be able to pay for their way out of the city. People who had to, quote, steal food because they had to feed their family. Those are stories that he's witnessed. You know, what I witnessed was people in boats giving rides to other people, people, you know, working a lot of time and hours to try and make sure everyone was taken care of. There was certainly a lot of chaos and a lot of fear. And I think a lot of the chaos and fear was driven by the media. When we would turn on the TV, there was no solid information. It would be so easy for a politician or anyone to say, this is what we know, and in 3 hours or in 6 hours or in 12 hours, we're going to give you an update about what you know. But at least the press that we were able to get from New Orleans, and we just had a battery-powered TV, and, you know, we could just get a couple stations. But one of the stations for a little while was actually relaying CNN, so we got a little bit of CNN as well. And what we got was, you know, just talk about looters, talk about flooding, no solid information, no information about how to get out, no information about, there was, you know, about what was happening with the levee that was broken, what it would take to fix it, how long it would be till the flooding went down. We still had actually a lot of hope that within a few days, the flooding would start to go down, which now we see is certainly not the case. But, you know, we could not get any information on that. There was no information. There was just fear-mongering. And the media in the U.S. has always demonized black people, and in this case, they were especially demonizing them. And it really, I think, helped to distract from the real criminals. There was billions of dollars of damage that was done to this city through what I would say is purposeful neglect and corruption, and that is the real crime, and that is not covered. It's amazing to me how much time they spent covering some people stealing thousands or even tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, if you count all the people all combined of maybe electronics equipment or whatever, versus billions of dollars of damage that was completely preventable and that was completely caused by our government and by politicians that didn't care and by this corporatization of our government and this cutting of any sort of infrastructure and of any support for infrastructure.
Okay, now my next question you've partly answered, but I think it's something that can be elaborated more, or we can talk more about, is the mainstream media has focused on the aid relief done by Red Cross, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Army, but they haven't talked about the community level or the grassroots aid relief. I think you touched a bit on that. Could you discuss the role grassroots and community organizations are playing in the aid relief and of their future role in the redevelopment of New Orleans?
This is, I think, the most vital topic that we can talk about, and it's completely related to the reconstruction of Iraq, the reconstruction of Southeast Asia post the tsunami. And, Naomi Klein has done some excellent writing on both of those topics. I know that she has something coming out soon on this topic. It is completely vital right now that we as people in solidarity with the people of New Orleans from all around the world really push for the money that comes in to go to the people of New Orleans. And anyone that listens to this, I especially urge people to go to www.sparkplugfoundation.org, sparkplugfoundation.org. And that has a listing of local, grassroots, democratic, people of color-led organizations with a long history of work in New Orleans who are doing relief and who are planning on taking the lead in reconstruction as well. And if we can get these people's committees to have control over reconstruction, they can save New Orleans. Because right now, New Orleans, as we know it, could be completely eliminated. You have hundreds of thousands of people that have been taken out of New Orleans and that have very little reason to go back. And these are people that have contributed so much to the city. The city will be reconstructed in some way, but how will it be reconstructed? Is it going to be reconstructed just for the rich, or just the rich area is going to be reconstructed? What corporations will get the reconstruction money? Will it be corporations or people? Is the Harrah's Casino and the hotels going to get the money? Will there be a newly built and enlarged aquarium? Who gets the money? Or will there be solid, long-lasting union jobs for masses of people to do that reconstruction, people that will stay in New Orleans and help to rebuild New Orleans? This, what New Orleans needs is something like the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal. It needs the equivalent of the Tennessee Valley Authority. It needs public institutions built up, controlled by the people of the city. It needs the poor areas of the city to be invested in, to be improved. The worst schools in the entire U.S. are in New Orleans, schools that still have lead paint, schools where many of the rooms cannot even be used because ceilings are falling in or other problems, schools that are completely, that are not usable. This money should go to rebuilding schools, new schools with computer access, with state-of-the-art schools. There should be high teacher salaries. And that goes back to the hurricane that hit New Orleans before Katrina, this hurricane of underfunding. We have the lowest teacher salaries. I think we're number 48th out of the U.S. We have the highest incarceration rate in the U.S. and Louisiana. If Louisiana were a country, it would have the highest incarceration rate in the world. Under Governor Huey Long, we actually had very close to a socialized healthcare system. We had very good healthcare coverage for the people of New Orleans, and something called the Charity Hospital System, which was free health care for the people of Louisiana. That has been cut and chipped away at until today, or 2 weeks ago, say, if you went to Charity Hospital, you would get free health care, but you would wait in line for at least 12 hours before you got to see a doctor. And that's just because the money has been chipped away and chipped away. The charity hospital system needs to be rebuilt and refunded. Public transportation needs to be funded. All of these things need to be funded, and they're not going to be funded unless people have control over the money that comes in and people fight for the money that comes in. And it's so upsetting to me to see among a lot of progressive people, and certainly in all of the mainstream people, and among a lot of people that care around the U.S., it just repeated over and over again, this is the number for Red Cross, and this is the number for these other agencies. Don't give your money to Red Cross. Give your money to local, democratic, grassroots groups in New Orleans, and spread the word to everyone you know to do the same. If that can get out there, if some of that money can go directly to those organizations, then they will be able to use that money for these progressive things. Even if that doesn't happen, we are also still fighting for one of our demands. One of the demands of these grassroots people's organizations is for them to have control and to supervise the spending of FEMA and Red Cross. And that's something else that we have to fight for, because Red Cross and FEMA will have billions of dollars to spend, and that money needs to be supervised by the people of New Orleans, not by Bush, not by bureaucrats, not by people with no history or connection to New Orleans.
In one of your articles, you write, "I didn't really understand community until I moved to New Orleans." Can you talk about that, New Orleans?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've lived in New Orleans for years, and I've tried for a long time to explain it to people, and it's hard if you haven't actually been there. But New Orleans is a place where, in the 1890s. Where the first Supreme Court challenge to the separate but equal clause came out of direct action formed by a citizens committee from New Orleans, where Dred Scott went and, even though he's black, sat in a white area, prefiguring Rosa Parks by about 70 years. So a committee formed for that direct action. There's long civil rights history. The Black Panthers had a chapter in the Desire Housing Projects, where the police came to kick them out, and hundreds of police came, and the entire community of the Desire Housing Projects stood up and stood between the police and the Black Panthers, and the police had to retreat. That's the history of New Orleans. You had the Deacons of Defense, who were in Monroe, Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans, who were armed self-defense of black folks standing up to the Ku Klux Klan. And this was in the 1950s, 10 years before the Black Panthers and others, and Malcolm X and others were talking about this armed self-defense. You have the Deacons of Defense pioneering that. That's New Orleans. You have right now this group in the Frederick Douglass High School, that overexploited high school I was mentioning earlier, this group called Teens with Attitude. It's a high school group that's formed from this completely exploited school, where they are grassroots and democratic and work to fight for educational equity. They went around and canvassed their community, canvassed the whole neighborhood around the school to increase community involvement in the school and make it a community-wide fight. This is a fight led by high school students who are in, as I say, the most overexploited school in the city. And that is New Orleans. New Orleans is also a place where many people know about jazz funerals or second lines, which is this roving street party that happens in New Orleans with a marching band that is a tradition out of the black community. But what a lot of people don't know is these second lines came out of these groups called Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs, which were formed in the black community in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as a form of social insurance because they couldn't get white insurance. So they formed these clubs as social insurance where they would have benefits and people would pay in a little bit of money. And then these clubs would take care of people if they needed health care, if they needed, they would provide burial insurance, and they would take care of families. And they would have benefits for families in special need. And they still, to this day, function in that way. They have benefits for families in need. They have benefits for the schools and for school books for kids. They also go to families who are in need and help them to set up vending at their events so they're able to make some money. And you see so much of these small community responses to massive job loss in the city where people are just selling whatever they can, little snacks or whatever, out of their home, and the people in the community pitch together to help that person make money, to help that person get by. When you walk down the street in New Orleans, you can spend a half hour or more walking one block because you talk to everyone on the porch. People are sitting on the porch. Everybody knows each other. Somebody will come up to you, you know, you're walking down the street, and someone who you know, who you haven't seen in a while, will say, "Hi, how are you?" And they listen, and they want to know the answer to that question. And they'll ask, they might ask, "Did you eat?" You know, like, "Did you eat? Do you need some food? What can I do?" Like, that's what people are like in New Orleans. People always want to feed you in New Orleans. It's a culture unlike everything else. And the culture of second lines, of jazz funerals, of Black Mardi Gras, of Mardi Gras Indians, which is a whole other discussion, but it's part of the Black Mardi Gras tradition. All of this came as a Black community response to white supremacist culture. And the way that a lot of people in New Orleans have traditionally resisted this white supremacist culture is by building this completely alternative culture, this underground culture, this word-of-mouth culture that is about community and about liberation.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
More than anything, I just want to say that we really need to fight for this community control of Reconstruction. We need to fight for New Orleans. New Orleans is a really wonderful, amazing, special place. And anyone that's listening to this that hasn't been there, I want you to be able to go there, and I want you to be able to go to the New Orleans as it is. But it's in serious danger of not existing anymore. And we need to fight for this, not just for New Orleans, but also for the next place that's hit by a natural disaster, because there's going to be more of these and, you know, unnatural disasters. And what happens in the aftermath of these disasters is vital, because the disaster can either be a chance for profit and for capital to control even more resources, or it can be a chance for community reinvestment. And New Orleans was hit by another hurricane long ago, over and over and over again, a long-lasting, brutal, violent hurricane of all of these, of neglect, of corruption, of deindustrialization, of disinvestment, and we need to fight back and we need to pull together.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Jordan Flaherty.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, sirree. Dear to me. Yes, sirree.
That was an interview with Jordan Flaherty, an editor of Left Turn magazine. He was in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina struck, and he talks about his personal experience during the hurricane, the aftermath, and he talks about the grassroots community organizing that is needed in the reconstruction of New Orleans. To read his articles, visit Left Turn magazine at www.leftturn.org. And to learn more about the grassroots aid relief going on in New Orleans, visit Sparkplug Foundation's website at www.sparkplugfoundation.org/katrinarelief.html.